the two Chinas, the two Koreas, and Japan. 1,000 nuclear warheads, a joint U.S.-South Korean naval force, and this answer to a question about the status of the Europeans. They've got their own problems with the Russians, we're told. You'd think we were reading the current headlines, but we're entering an early scene in a novel titled Hunter Killer by David Poyer. A four-star admiral outlines his military strategy with projected maps. He says, "We're digging in on the line Honshu, Saipan, Guam, the second island chain. We've bought or been granted a breathing space while China's premier and his naval staff chief consolidate their gains. Taiwan, Korea, Okinawa, Vietnam, those battles will determine whether this so-called People's Empire pulses outward again." Younger Hans nodded, and the next screen showed the South China Sea. "We already have a left hook started. On hold at the moment, but it can resume once we beef up our shipping numbers and reassure the Australians and the Indonesians they can release some of their covering forces. Next, please. A kidney-shaped island. Let's look more closely at Taiwan, an idea think tank in D.C.'s pitching. How solid is the mainland's grip? Granted, they hold the west coast, the plain, and the northern metropolis, Taipei and its industrial and residential suburbs, but that's not the whole island. It might be possible to strand 500,000 troops on Taiwan, cut them off, and force them to surrender. An island, Stalingrad. If our other allies hold, that may give us a chance at war termination on reasonable terms." A scene in which the commander displays maps, outlines his vision and the goal, and the strategy for getting to that goal in the novel Hunter Killer by David Poyer. We can contrast that strategic session with a later scene centering on escaped American POWs. Since leaving the prison camp days before, they'd walked by night single file, navigating by the stars, which were brilliant and close, more than bright enough to hike by, even across this rough ground. Obi let Fieros lead, since the pilot seemed to have a clear idea where he was going. Keeping the North Star on his right, he'd pick out a peak or an escarpment ahead, then line up on it until the lay of the land concealed it or they got lost in one of the gullies they mostly followed. Then he'd halt them and crawl up to where he could catch the guiding star again. In contrast with the admiral and his strategic plan to reach the targeted goal, in this scene, the characters also have a goal to make it to safety, safely, but they're in the moment, relying on guidance from the world of nature, as the ancients did, following their intuition in the dark. As it happens, such scenes might just characterize David Poyer's way of working as an author. In a profile from the Pennsylvania Center for the Book, Poyer says, "I teach writing at Wilkes University's creative writing program, and there I'm considered the structure guy in that I believe in thorough planning before putting fingers to keyboard. It's a step-by-step process from character sketches to character matrices, to scene outline, to detailed outline, to first draft." But we're about to hear Poyer describe a shift in his process, where he's become more attuned to the guidance of the North Star-like muse, perhaps. Reflecting to his life as a seaman, both on high-tech naval vessels and relying on all his senses as he sails his own small sloop in and around his home on Virginia's eastern shore. Yet David Poyer was born in Du Bois, Pennsylvania, and he grew up in Clearfield County. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis in 1971 and later received a master's degree from George Washington University. His active and reserve naval service included sea duty in the Atlantic, Mediterranean, Arctic, Caribbean, and Pacific, and shore duty at the Pentagon, Surface Warfare Development Group, Joint Forces Command, and in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Poyer began writing in 1976 and he's the best-selling author of over 40 books, naval novels, books set in the Pennsylvania Hills, underwater adventure stories, an historical thriller, a comic novel, volumes of the Civil War at Sea. David Poyer, as we heard, teaches in the Maslow Family Creative Writing Program at Wilkes, and he is returning for the annual June residency there, getting underway this Sunday. There will be a series of public readings throughout the week ahead, and David Poyer will be featured this Tuesday, June 19th, as part of a night of fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction at the Dart Center on campus. David Poyer paid a visit to the WVIA studios during the January residency to talk with us about his writing life and his ties to Pennsylvania.
I was born in Dubois and grew up in Emlenton and Bradford, and consider myself, if I'm a native of anywhere, I guess I'm a native of Bradford. And then, as you say, I went away to the Navy and saw the world. And now it seems I'm back in Pennsylvania teaching at the Maslow Family Creative Writing Program at Wilkes. So that's kind of a return, a full circle, if you will. So, yes, Pennsylvania, exactly. And it's a strange state. It is a keystone state. It is a state that's seen a lot of history. And that's kind of the things I wanted to write about in my Pennsylvania series.
As a little one in Bradford, that wasn't part of your growing up? You weren't writing little stories, or were you, in grade school?
Oddly enough, Eric, my cousin, who now lives in Erie, says that I used to write little stories, but I don't remember any of them, and I don't actually have any of them. So it would be interesting to look at those old stories if they ever resurfaced, but I don't know.
Were you aware of Lake Erie and the naval activity on the lake, even though you weren't there?
Not really until my bishop gave me a sort of scholarship for an essay that I wrote, and I got to go to Erie and meet the bishop and go on Niagara, right? USS Niagara. So that was my first intimation of the Navy, I guess about age 13 or 14.
Were you a young reader?
Oh, yes. I mean, I went through that public library like you wouldn't believe. And we got a chance to pay back because the county that Lenore and I moved to later had no library. So we were instrumental in raising the money to build it, and it's been operating for about 8 years now. Always full. Little library, always full. People always in front of the computers, always standing in line to check books out. So I feel great that I was able to pay Andrew Carnegie back a little bit.
That's quite a story about his push for libraries, isn't it, in that way?
Oh, we could use some more public-spirited benefactors like old Andy.
So your young imagination was filled with stories of all kinds then. Were you drawn to fiction equally with nonfiction? Were you a voracious reader and reading everything?
I think I was reading pretty much everything, economics and science and history and novels, of course. I was a pretty Catholic reader in both senses, I guess.
The path from Bradford to Annapolis to the Navy, what did it for you?
Well, I knew I had to get out of town. I mean, I'm sure lots of the people listening remember that they had to get out of their hometown, because when you stay in your hometown, you're always going to be what you are, and you can never become what you're going to be. So I had to get out of there, and they gave me a scholarship to Cornell, and I almost went there, but then the appointment to Annapolis came through, and I thought, gee, Cornell is how many miles away, and the Navy is going to take me so many places, so that was an easy choice there. Plus, they would pay me to go to Annapolis.
What was happening on the world stage when you were attending Annapolis?
All my friends were registering for the draft. A lot of my friends went. Some of my friends are in the graveyard in my hometown. So that's the main thing that was going on, and we were at the Naval Academy fully expecting to go to war as soon as we got out. So that lent a sort of dark edge to the whole experience. It was not really expected it would do anything but go to war once we got out. And then some classes historically have even graduated early from the Academy to be sent to war, so we were always on edge for that one. That one didn't happen. But then when I'd graduated, the war was winding down, so I applied for destroyer duty in the North Atlantic, in the Arctic, in the Caribbean, and that's where the first Navy novel came from, The Circle. It was based on a mission that our frigate was assigned to go north of the Arctic Circle into wintertime, find the biggest storm we could find, and stay in it as long as we could survive. That was the mission. And the reason for it, of course, was that we had a new sonar device on board, and the point of the whole mission was to see if a ship could survive and if the thing would operate in conditions like that. Well, it almost didn't. We had some serious damage and had some mountainous seas and some pretty hairy experiences. It was a single screw ship, and if you know anything about ships and heavy seas, if you have only one screw on the thing and you have any kind of engineering casualty, you broach and you can roll over and then you go down, which happened to several destroyers in the Pacific in World War II. Of course, I didn't know that we were in such danger as that. I was a green ensign and perfectly happy doing what I was told. But I recorded everything in my little tape recorder brain and used that in The Circle.
In the midst of all this frigid temperatures and the rolling of the sea and all of that and the danger, were you then thinking, I could write this, or it was just that you happened to absorb it all? Did you have a sense then that you could write about these things?
It was not that I could. It was that I would, Erica. I had known I was a writer since I was about 3, and my mother had taken me out on the back porch. And we were looking at various things, and I was asking, as little kids will, you know, who made the sky, right? God made the sky. Who made the grass, right? God made the grass. I pick up the book, because she always read to me. Well, who made this book? And she said, writers write books. And I knew right then what I was and what I was going to do. And that was kind of an idée fixe. I was going to do it no matter what. At the academy, I would make notes and hide them in my shoes and then quickly stuff them into the letters home so that the upper class didn't see what I was doing, because it was strictly forbidden to make any kind of diary, journal, or note. So that was the genesis of The Return of Philo T. McGiffin, which is my comic novel of Annapolis, still in print after 30 years.
And do they read it there?
Yes, they sure do.
And the idea about the not writing the notes, is that security?
Yes, absolutely, because captured diaries are a primary intelligence source. And then I heard several years after I graduated that it was mandatory to keep a diary. So that was perfectly consistent, you know, in my mind, you know, at the academy, it's either forbidden or mandatory. There's no in between.
At what point did you read Moby Dick? I want to know whether you're out there in the Navy on these ships and Ahab is in your consciousness.
When did I read it? Well, I've read it several times over the years. Gosh, it must have been 16 or 17 the first time. But it does stick in your brain. And I was going to do something like a sequel to Moby Dick at one time. But that got kind of derailed when In the Heart of the Sea came out, because I had already outlined the book and then written the first chapter. Then The Heart of the Sea came out, and I saw that I was kind of preempted there. So what I did was I turned the story around and wrote a novel recasting Moby Dick in modern dress. It's called The Whiteness of the Whale, and the protagonist is a female scientist, an ethnologist, who has been ejected from her college because she left the lock off of a chimpanzee's cage, and it ate the face off of one of her interns. So she is persona non grata at that university, any university, basically anywhere. So she signs on to an expedition that is kind of like the Sea Shepherds, although I don't use that terminology. And they are sailing down to the Antarctic to try to stop Japanese whalers. So it's kind of a turnaround of the Moby Dick story. And each of the characters in the book is a retranslation of one of the characters in Moby Dick into modern dress. And then they meet the whale, and things get scary after that. Lots of fun writing that book, because it was also the first book I had done, well, I had had female characters before, but I'd never had a female protagonist before. And when I was writing that, about halfway through, I realized I was thinking like a woman. I was seeing the world differently, because up to then, I had always seen the world in terms of forces and objects. And now I was seeing it in terms of human relationships above all, which I realized, well, that kind of illuminated a lot of the exchanges that I had had with my wife and others over the years. So in a sense, I guess that wised me up to some things.
When you're a writer and you're at sea, there are rhythms of the day that you are tied to, the sunrise, sunset. You're plugged into the wind and the rhythms of the sea because it's so visceral. Does that affect you as a writer, what you do maybe instinctively?
Well, I think in days past or in smaller boats, you might feel more in tune with the sea and with the seasons and with the time. In today's Navy, you're isolated from the sea. You're in front of a screen. The screen may tilt a little bit, but aside from that, you're in an air-conditioned, isolated, armored, sealed-off, hermetically sealed space. And you can go for days without even seeing the ocean, unless you're obviously on the bridge team, in which case you're up there staring at the sea. But even then, you're 80 feet up. And mainly you're looking at radar screens and interacting with the electronics. Now, in a small boat, that was what The Whiteness of the Whale was so fun, because I'm a small boat sailor, have my own hunter sloop. And that was fun because when you're in a smaller craft facing 40-foot waves, ice, heavy seas, terribly low temperatures, then it becomes visceral. That was your word, right? Visceral. And I've had people tell me they had to stop reading The Whiteness of the Whale and go and get a coat and come back and put it on.
That's about the best compliment. Let's just keep it on the small boat scale. Mm-hmm. It's not just this kind of rocking and the wind, but it's also sound. Isn't there an awful lot of wind whipping across your ears? So it's that total experience.
It's never totally silent. When things go silent, especially in a naval ship, you're in big trouble. When the fans go down, when the power goes out, when you're not being propelled, you're ready to, you know, receive a salvo, and it's not going to be pretty.
In terms of writing stories, telling stories, is there a society on board these ships that you have talked about, the large ones now, not the little ones, hierarchies or whatever, but a way of interacting, certain rules, unspoken rules about the way you all live together in a place like that?
Well, I think there are spoken and unspoken rules. There are certainly hierarchies. The Navy has always been famous for having rigid hierarchies, which are necessary, I think, when you live all cooped up in a 200 or 400 foot long steel or wooden shell. So, yes, we definitely have hierarchies. But I think what you might have been talking about, Erica, is a feeling of shipmates, a feeling of comradeship, a feeling of must be what soldiers feel like in small units in battle. But in the Navy, you're always in battle against the sea. It's not really peacetime ever for you. The collisions in the Sea of Japan, you know, that's we're operating 24/7 around the world, and there's really no downtime.
How long did you spend on active duty?
Let's see, 7 years active duty, and the rest of my 30-year career I spent reserve duty, but still going to sea.
And you were writing how much of that time?
Well, there's not a whole lot of time to write at sea, but you can squeeze out a little bit of time. So some of the short stories I wrote in Destroyers found their way into later books.
We'd imagine that even though you're writing about life on shipboard and the dangers and conflicts arising in that world, that we'll identify with the characters in their human ways, and so it becomes universal in that way. Though it's in a very compelling circumstance that we may not get to experience in any other way than through the gifts of your stories.
Of course, writing is a process of self-discovery, and that's one of the things that we try to help our students along with in the Wilkes Creative Writing Program at Wilkes University, is to help the writers discover their own stories and to access their memories, fears, hopes, desires, and make those universal, like you just said, whether it's in poetry or drama or screenwriting or novels or short stories or graphic novels. We have faculty members in all those disciplines, if you will.
Take us to this story, if you would, David, the one set right here in our state, novel of 1936, Thunder on the Mountain. What was the impetus for telling this particular story?
Well, Erica, this is the concluding volume of my Dark Pennsylvania or Pennsylvania Noir 4-book series. The first was The Dead of Winter, Winter in the Heart, As the Wolf Loves Winter, and Thunder on the Mountain. And in the first three books, they were set in the generic present, if you will, kind of modern day, maybe from 1970 until the present. But the characters in this small town kept talking about things that had happened back in 1936. And I had no idea what they were talking about, but they kept mentioning the events of 1936 again and again. And finally, I realized they were telling me I had to go back and write about when they were in their 20s, and it was 1936, and they were young people. So they told me that I had to write this book. That's the genesis.
And the fact is that writers who have been sitting where you're sitting tell us that so often the characters take the shape and have taken the shape that they do because they tell you as a writer that this is who they are, and that's the process you're describing?
Yes, I think so. The characters, I don't think they really write themselves, but something is writing them that you don't have an entirely rational access to, and it's important for a writer to be open to that. I'm kind of famous or infamous at Wilkes for being a deep believer in outlining and constructing the story in your head, or maybe on paper, before you begin writing it, so that I know pretty much what the story arc is, and I know my characters, and I know the scenes before I begin writing. Not all writers work that way, but I feel more comfortable. You know, I set out on a journey to have a map and to have a destination. So if I have a map, a route, and a destination, I feel I can get there, and usually I do.
So even though you have this framework, there is something else.
You have to leave it open for the muse to speak to you, absolutely. And I don't want to seem too mystical about this, but once you begin a book, things that you need will appear. Things will, I guess the force is with you or something, and you begin to meet people who have something to contribute to the book. You begin to see items in the newspaper or online that say, wow, that is exactly what I needed to have. So that's kind of a feeling that you're on the right track.
What happened in 1936 that these people were prompting you to investigate?
Well, our central character is W.T. Kid Nitro Halverson. He's an oil well shooter. He's a semi-pro boxer. And he's in love with Jenny Washko, whose parents do not like him because he's not a Catholic and he's not Slovak, and they consider his profession very dangerous, and they don't have a heck of a lot of respect for boxers either. So WT, or Red as he comes to be known, or Kid Nitro is his boxing name, is caught up in young love, labor troubles, the seamy underbelly of 1930s boxing, and quite a few other things in the story of 1936 in PA. Oh, and I should mention Silver Shirts and KKK and state police and lots of other great things that were happening in the 30s here.
And you were good enough to take a napkin and mark a space. And I'd love it if you'd read that for us.
Well, I'll read a little bit here. Yeah, this is when WT, who everybody here calls Billy, is attending a Slovak wake. His girlfriend's brother has just been killed in an industrial accident, and he has to go and visit. The porch light was on. People in dark clothes sat on the steps and stood about in the snow in the front yard. A plume of smoke streamed up from the chimney, glowing palely in the light of the gas flares. As he came up the walk, he heard women wailing inside the house. Round Slavic faces turned as he passed. That strange rapid language, the women in their clumsy boots and long coats and bright patterned babushkas, made him feel different and tall and American. He stamped his boots off on the porch, not wanting to go in, but knowing he had to. Viola opened the door. The little girl looked frightened and her face was swollen. "Hi, Billy," she said. He patted her head and went in, leaving his boots on the slush mat and padding on in his stocking feet. Old Washko was sitting in front of the Philco, a bottle of liquor and a glass in front of him. The radio was on, but it wasn't tuned to a station. It was just on, humming and glowing in the darkened parlor. Another shadow, just as motionless, turned out to be Bernard. Elverson looked into the darkness beyond them. "Jenny?" Washko opened his eyes. He stared dully at Halverson, then motioned to the body. Billy Halverson, take drink whiskey," he said. "No thanks, Mr. Washko. I heard the news out on the lease. I'm sorry about Johnny." Johnny all right. Johnny home tonight. Take drink," I said. Washko struggled up and with glassy eyes poured him the tumbler full of rye. They watched him as he took a slug, coughing as raw spirit seared his throat. The old man picked up the bottle and tilted it above stubbled jaws. Halverson looked back into the darkness again. He said, "Bernard, how are you doing?" "I can take it," said the kid. When he set the tumbler down, Washko lurched forward and grabbed it again. Liquor gurgled. "Sir, that's enough." "Nah, plenty whiskey. Maybe better this way. Johnny probably die in next war anyway." The cheap Monongahela burned in his gut. Jenny's face took shape out of the dim. He got up and went toward her, carrying the glass. She stood immobile as he hugged her, then her arm came up as if she'd just remembered who he was, but it didn't stay, just pressed his back, then let go. "I'm real glad you came," she said. "He's back there." The coffin was set up on the dining room table, almost filling the cramped, dark room. The lid was nailed down. Votive candles spluttered on the buffet. A dozen women in dark clothes were weeping and talking loudly in Slovak and eating store cookies out of a tin. To his horror, Halverson slowly became aware of the smell of roasted meat. He wanted to leave again, but got a grip and kept on following Jenny. She turned once to ask him if he wanted to see her ma. He nodded. Mrs. Washko lay in the back bedroom, swathed in an ancient black taffeta dress. A rusty shawl covered her face. The room smelled of damp and mold. The smaller children huddled against her recumbent form like lifeboats against the side of some great foundering liner. Halverson didn't think she saw him when she opened her eyes. He said he was sorry to hear about Johnny. He was a good boy. She said something. Jenny spoke to her in the same language, stroking her hair as the children stared at him. "What did she say?" "She said, thank you for coming." "Is that all?" "She said a lot more than that." "Come on, Bill. This is my Aunt Margaret, Uncle Jim. These are the Yannick girls. They're our cousins from Brandy Camp. This is Sister Cecilia, Margaret's girl. She teaches at the convent. This is Bill Halverson. He works drilling wells for Thunder." He shook hands with the men and bowed awkwardly to the women. Finally, he got her alone behind the kitchen door. "Is there anything I can do for your ma or for the family?" he muttered. "Anything I can go get?" "I don't think so, but I'm glad you came, Bill." "Are they going to need anything for the funeral?" "No, ma has burial policies on all us kids from the First Catholic Slovak Ladies' Union. $100 each. Are you coming to the funeral?" She searched his face anxiously. "Tomorrow at 10, at St. Denis's. I really need you to be there, Bill." He took his watch out and looked at it, not to see what time it was, just to look somewhere else than at all the grieving faces. Yeah, I'll be there. Look, I got to go now. There's a meeting downtown." "There's not going to be any trouble, is there?" "What do you mean?" "I don't know. Just be careful," she said. Her nose wrinkled. "You smell like whiskey. Your dad made me drink it. Here, take the glass." He patted her shoulder, then went out past the humming radio and the silent pair in the parlor and down the steps back into the freezing darkness between the wavering, crazy dance of the gas flares.
So many telling details, and yet it all holds together and it feels real. And for those who know ethnic communities, that's how it was. And could, in fact, be something that might still be.
Sure it is. It's a tapestry, Erica. You're weaving together things that you've experienced, stories that you've heard, research that you do, and pure imagination. And it's all woven together, and and one hopes that the resulting picture will make sense.
Best-selling author David Poyer, who teaches in the Maslow Family Creative Writing Program at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, speaking with us and reading from his novel, Thunder on the Mountain, a novel of 1936, issued by Northampton House Press. David Poyer paid a visit to the WVIA studios during the January residency to talk with us about his writing life. And he's returning now for the annual June residency, getting underway this Sunday and continuing into most of next week on the Wilkes University campus. There will be a series of public readings in connection with that residency. It's titled the Maslow Foundation Salon Reading Series, and it will run from this Sunday, June 17th, through the 21st, mostly on the campus of Wilkes. It gets underway, though, at Barnes & Noble on South Main Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre, and that will feature poetry, creative nonfiction, and a fiction sampler, works of Bill Schneider, Christine Gelinow, Robert Mooney, Rachel Hughes, Taylor Polites, Laurie Lowenstein, Nisha Sharma, and Laura Jean Kennedy. And that's at 7 at Barnes & Noble on Public Square, or just off Public Square in downtown Wilkes-Barre. Monday, they're having a private film screening, so that won't be a public event. But then Tuesday, June 19th at 7 at the Dart Center for the Performing Arts on the Wilkes campus. It's a night of fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction. And David Poyer will be featured as part of that. Also, Lenore Hart, who is his life partner, his wife, David Poyer and Lenore Hart, and we've heard her on Art Scene. Kevin Oderman, J. Michael Lennon, Jeff Talarigo, Nancy McKinley, and Phil Brady, and we've had most of them as guests on Art Scene. Wednesday, June 20th, 7 to 9 is the next one at the Dart Center, and it will continue into Thursday. Now, there is a very special reading, and that will include alumni and faculty, and that will showcase the new anthology titled My Body, My Words, a collection of bodies, Amy Archer, Lauren Kleiman, Beverly D'Onofrio, Leah Vernon, Dawn Leese, Brian Finelli, and Kaylee Jones. And that's a very special offering as part of the reading series at Wilkes this week. Again, it gets underway this Sunday evening at 7 at Barnes & Noble, South Main Street in Wilkes-Barre, just off Public Square. There will be also a public reading on Tuesday, June 19th, and our guest today, David Poyer, will be part of that reading, and that's at 7 at the Dart Center. Wednesday, June 20th, it's Playwrights Night, and Thursday, June 21st at 7 is the new anthology's introduction, My Body, My Words. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu. And for information about our guest online, poyer.com, and that's P-O-Y-E-R.com.